S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that mixes things up just to make sure you're paying attention. I'm not Andrew Page, I'm Scott Phillips, and with me
is Andrew Page. How are you going?
I'm good, buddy. How are you?
Feels a little bit odd.
101st podcast, mate. We don't want to be sucking our ways here.
Every 100 episodes,
we'll change one thing, exactly. Just to make sure our listeners are awake. Exactly.
Keeping it fresh.
Mate, today on the podcast, we're going to cover the best of Warren and Charlie, 2018 edition. That's a Berkshire hint. We're going to talk about the federal budget, but don't switch off. We're not going to make it. Oh, come on. We're going to try and make it interesting. Mm-hmm. We're going to open the foolish mailbag. We've got heaps of mail to get through, so yes. We're going to do our best to get through that in a reasonable amount of time. And unfortunately, even though I'm hosting,
Hey. You
do get a chance to, if we have time, and we may not, Liam, I might have to cut this off early just because...
There's always time.
Well, if we do have time, you will be getting on
making time. We'll
your
do a PS
horse.
If there's not time.
Mate, if the high horse ever becomes a PS, we're in a world of hurt because it could go for hours.
It would.
And another thing. All right, mate. So Warren and Charlie, The Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting was on Sunday. Started at 1 a.m. Sydney time.
52nd edition?
Pretty sure it was. Yep. 1965, current management took over, so That'd be about right.
Yep.
Warren Buffett, of course, Charlie Munger, the two men, the 87-year-old, the 92-year-old who run Berkshire Hathaway.
Yep.
They sat down and talked to their audience in Omaha, Nebraska for 6 hours straight and took questions from all comers, journos, fund managers, and the general public. What did you think of it?
I got a confession to make.
Oh, no.
I didn't listen to most of it. I tuned in for the end, and even then, I sort of had it on in the background.
Dude, this is supposed to be an investing podcast.
I know. And what was fascinating, so we on Monday came around, the investment team, we always get together, we have a bit of a chat. I wasn't alone. A lot of us supposed investing hardcore fanboys, this is like a Catholic,
careful.
Not listening to.
Oh, dear. Well, careful.
Oh, no. I was just going to say. It's like ignoring the Pope, right?
Okay, good.
Don't you think? And I'm admitting, I'm confessing my sins here.
So the first podcast I host, you start with, I've got nothing.
I'll tell you.
We might have to cut this and start again. We'll probably just,
Well, let's do it.
Is there anyone else outside in the office here who I could bring in for Andrew's kind of. Mate, I'm really just, living up to
it's not,
expectations.
It's not easy taking the lead. I made it look easy for the first 100.
It's not the lead I'm worried about. It's the help I'm getting. Exactly.
Well, I'll say this, and I think it is fascinating. So, why is and anyone who's listened to this podcast for any length of time would just bang their head on the wall because we talk about this bloody octogenarian investor constantly.
Yes, we do.
And yet, he gives his sermon at his once a year annual meeting, and I didn't tune in and. I guess the reason was, and the other guys sort of seem to echo this, is that there's a couple of things. One is it is a commitment. It is 6.5 hours or so.
Yeah, to learn from the best investor in the world for free only once a year.
Yeah,
and
unlike in many, it's only the second or third time they've actually broadcast online.
Yep.
So normally there was no way onto the inside without actually being there.
Or following a live blog that we used to do when it wasn't live broadcast.
That's true. But you couldn't actually hear it from the horse's mouth.
Correct.
Look, mate, for me, it's funny because... anyone who's read much of Buffett's stuff or followed him or done all this other kind of stuff is that there's nothing new that's there. And even when I was there in person, we were there for the 50th anniversary.
We were. You hadn't helped out with the live blog, as I recall.
Let's not go there. It's a little bit jet lagged, perhaps a little bit hungover. I didn't do a great job.
I was going to drop you in on, mate, but if you want to drop yourself in, then.
You can't hint about it, then not talk about it.
I didn't say that. Anyway, you helped with the podcast.
It was great. It was such an experience. But as I said at the time, there was nothing new there. Now, here's the thing. I actually think that's a wonderful thing because investing is something that just has, like a lot of things, there's certain eternal truths that were true 50 years ago, that'll be true 50 years in the future. So the investment quote-unquote guru who every year has got a new way of doing things is probably a charlatan.
Yes.
So that's what we should expect.
Yep.
But for someone who's been so close to it for so long and who's read all the annual letters and listened to a bunch of meetings, I just, when it came around to getting up at the crack of dawn.
Before the crack of dawn, right?
Before the crack
of
dawn.
An hour after midnight.
And sitting for 6.5 hours, I just didn't do it.
But you have looked at some of the highlights. And we know that there was something of a challenge for you, Andrew, this time. Because you had the irresistible force, meaning the immovable object. The two heroes in your life, the two objects of your manly affection, Warren Buffett and Elon Musk were at loggerheads. And I'm still trying to work out how you resolve that tension without somehow blowing up.
Torn between two lovers. I know. It was... There's room in my life for both of these guys.
So tell me why there was disagreement.
Well, Musk basically said something.
The boss of Tesla, SpaceX.
The man doesn't need an introduction, for God's sake. This Elon, Mr. M, was basically saying that moats were a quaint idea.
Right. And what's a moat?
A bit of a dig. And a moat is a term that Mr. Buffet coined.
I was waiting for you to use that phrase again.
Which basically refers to a sustainable competitive advantage, some kind of characteristic about a business that allows it to earn outsized returns that prevents competitors from coming in and eating your lunch.
And the idea of a moat around a castle, keeping it safe, letting you go about your business well and successfully, and being able to keep the marauders at bay.
There's a lot of aspects to Buffett's investment strategy, but that is at the core of it. He looks for these businesses that are able to, with these big, fat, deep, sustainable moats around them that can just go on compounding their earnings year after year after year. And that's basically the secret to his success.
So Coca-Cola, for example, massive, massive brand distribution network, lots of things that are very, very hard for its competitors to mimic. And what gives Coke the ability to earn much more profit than Pepsi or Andrew Kohler or Scott Kohler or anything else that comes
along. One of his more recent investments with Apple, right? Another one, huge brand advantage and a whole other bunch of reasons.
Shout out to Doc who works with us, who will be happy to hear
us mention
Apple.
Huge fanboy, yeah. And then Musk comes out and says, yeah, I don't know if that's right.
He said moats are lame.
And he said, well, actually, what really matters is innovation. Yep. Innovation, the world is moving much faster. There's a lot more technology orientation around business today. You innovate or you die.
All right.
So you can have a huge moat, but if you're not innovating, then you're in trouble.
And so
there's truth to what both of these guys are saying.
Time to make a decision.
Mm. I'm not going to deal in absolutes.
I'll play the perfect match music. Will you decide whether you want to choose seat number two or bachelor number one or bachelor number two? Andrew.
I'm two-timing.
Who
my
will
friend.
It be?
No, I'm two. I think they both make good.
Oh, come on.
I'll say this. As much as I have affection for both of them, Elon's a little bit crazy, right? I know that there's every chance in the, you know,
lovably
few years
crazy.
In the future, it's going to be this really embarrassing thing to admit that, I used to think he was pretty cool because he's just going to do something really, really crazy.
That's a pretty good
You know,
chance,
he's going to be wearing tissue boxes on his feet and, you know, growing his nails like 10 centimeters long and living in some hyperbaric chamber. He's that kind of guy. So you've got to take what he says with a little bit of grain of salt. But I would say they're both right. I would say having a moat actually gives you the resources to effectively invest in innovation and do all of these. There's a lot of
innovation done well kind of is its own moat, right?
It is. So they're kind of like these two billionaires sort of duking it out and trolling at each other. And really, they're kind of circling around the same thing. There's some subtle differences there.
Yep.
But I think it's just Elon being Elon and I don't know, being a bit of a dick, if I can say that about him. And Warren being, you know, the wise elder statesman sort of handling it very well. But and didn't Elon say he was going to start his own candy company as well to go against
after Buffett said, well, I don't think Elon's right. We have a candy company that's got a pretty good moat. That's Sees Candies, which is excellent, by the way.
And not much innovation going on in there.
And so Elon decides he wants to start a candy company to prove something, which is interesting. And I'm sure, frankly, there are so many nutty fanboys out there for Tesla that if he launched Tesla chocolates, I'm sure they would sell a lot, at least for a couple of years.
You know they would, right? Okay, so enough about that.
Tesla, by the way, is a brand, which is a moat.
It is. It is an intangible asset. So give me, before we speak too long about this, just give me a couple of the-
Before we speak too long.
A couple of key takeaways as someone who did sit through it. What?
Excuse me.
I know you've talked before about it's a wonderful chance to refresh.
Yeah. So look, what I love about the Berkshire meeting, so here's the thing. I liken it to the once a year going to church, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the opportunity for the preacher to stand at the front and say, hey, you lot, don't forget, these are the rules that we try and live by.
Yeah.
And so to some degree, and again, those aren't religious, they won't make so much sense. But to some degree, it's sitting at the feet of the master and just being again kind of reminded of the stuff that matters in investing. And it's one of those things where very little, as you say, is brand new, but it's very, very hard to read. Even if you just read a few quotes from the meeting, it's hard to read those and kind of not go, yeah, that's right, I must remember that. Or, yeah, exactly, that's really important. And there is a process of, you know, as humans, we're so wired towards going for the latest thing, the flashy thing, the new thing, you know, what's new in investing? Oh, that guy's got a new plan. I'll go and have a look at that. Mm. And we kind of think about Buffett and we think, well, we know all that stuff. We don't have to worry about that. And that's okay, except that our brains don't really deal well with, old home truths that are somewhere in the back of our minds. We're much more likely to respond to the new and the different and the
new
urgent
thing. Yeah.
Right. And so to some degree, it's absolutely that benefit. Even I was there with you a couple of years ago. And just having that experience, like you come back and you think, okay, well, let's start again. Now, yeah. We know I'll name drop, and it's a shareholding of mine. Sol Patz is a company listed on the ASX. Mm-hmm. Robert Milner, the chairman of that company, mm-hmm. has been going to Berkshire every year, went again this year.
Well, he was the reason we were hungover. Well, if I can dob him in there.
Let's not slander Robert too much, but right. he may have been a very enjoyable luncheon and after lunch drinks partner.
Yeah.
Sorry, Rob, we've dropped you in it there. Yeah. Mind you, he pulled up better than you did.
Easily.
Anyway, so he's been going every year, and you know he's a guy who is worth a squillion in his own right. Runs a very successful company. He doesn't need to be there to learn anything new, but it's that process of just re-imbuing yourself with that stuff that is. That's the key value. Talked about one thing was really interesting. I'm an Amazon shareholder again, as mm-hmm. people would know. I'm Berkshire holder too, for mm-hmm. full disclosure. Mm-hmm. And he talked about Amazon, and people said, "Why didn't you invest in Amazon?" And he said, "Well, when I saw what Jeff Bezos was going to do, I thought it'd be a miracle, it'd be successful, and it has been a miracle." Mm. He said, "I just don't invest in miracles." And so there was some sense of just because those things are successful, could you have reasonably said in 1997, "Here's a company or companies, which one of those is going to be successful to beat Walmart at its own game?" Mm. You need it to be spectacularly good. Mm. And some people bought Amazon. Some people think they picked it. Some people are lucky to have picked it. Buffett was like, I couldn't, using my own framework, decide or know that was going to be successful. Mm. So I simply just chose not to take part. And I thought that was a circle of competence is a really big thing. You don't have to know everything about everything. Yep. You don't have to invest in everything. Just buy the stuff you think you know about and have an advantage with.
Before we move on, What did Charlie say about Bitcoin, mate?
I think he might have referred to it as a turd from memory.
He may have used that word. I'll leave it at that. A smart man.
How much are you up in your Bitcoin purchase?
How much have I lost is a better question, and the answer is nothing.
How much have you gained?
Nothing as well.
Oh, I'm ahead then, I suppose.
Didn't you just give a lesson about it's okay to miss out if you don't understand something?
I'm just saying I'm ahead with it. I must have understood it better than you. That's all I can say. I assume that must be true.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking of things that I didn't pay attention to and that you did.
And reasons you're going to introduce this topic, you don't have to answer the first question on it.
I got in quickly there.
You did.
The federal budget.
Oh, the most exciting night of the year.
I'm going to dob you in as that hardcore nerd who cooks the popcorn beforehand, you know, who turns the phone off, who sits there, watches all the coverage, tweets out a storm on every thought that comes through your head.
That's at TMF Scott P for those who want to see my budget Twitter storm.
I didn't see it, mate. And again, I know this is a finance podcast, so that's pretty shameful. I've had a pretty bad run this week.
That's right. Which value are you adding again this week?
Can you give me and our listeners who are like me a quick roundabout tour with being as apolitical as you can?
Oh, mate, it's hard. So, yeah, I enjoy the budget so much that my wife said to my son with a twinkle in her eye, "I'll put you to bed. Daddy's got to watch the budget." And she looked at me with that look like, "You poor, poor, sad man," which was, you know,
well, she could have just kept him up and he would have fallen asleep by himself anyway.
Exactly. So, yes, look, it was a really fascinating budget for a whole lot of reasons. It's obviously a very political budget. Mm-hmm. And we did see last night Bill Shorten's reply speech. And so there's lots of politics flying around.
We saw?
Okay.
You saw?
Yeah, it happened.
Okay.
Trust me.
I believe you.
Lots of politics, and we try and stay out of the politics in as much as we can here. We try and focus on policy, not politics, mm-hmm. And economics rather than vote buying. So from both parties, this is a pre-election budget. Whether we get another one before the next election is kind of a moot point. They're both setting up for budgets, and they're dueling tax cuts.
Mm. My tax cut is bigger than yours.
Exactly what it was, right? Yeah. And so you know, $10 a week for most people out of Malcolm Turnbull's, well, Scott Morrison's budget, $20 for most people out of Bill Shorten's budget reply. So it was that kind of week. Mm-hmm. In terms of the changes, I suppose one of the big ones is that the Libs and Nats promised or want to have enacted tax cuts that go out 7 years, including a really, really substantial change to the system, which is basically that they're going to have amounts to effectively a flat tax for anybody earning between 40 grand and 200 grand a year, which is the largest kind of structural philosophical change to the tax system that we will see if it happens. And look, it's 7 years away and it may never get passed. But conceptually, that would be an enormous change to what's previously been what they call a progressive system, which is you pay a higher rate of tax the more you earn. This kind of
things going up in brackets.
Exactly.
So the brackets are still there. It's just one very big, wide bracket.
Well, actually, they're taking one out altogether, right, for a start.
So it's become one big, long, wide one.
Exactly, exactly.
So here's the argument that I've heard for the flat tax is it's just simpler and it's fairer and it's easier for all.
Yes.
What would you say to that?
One and three are very easy. That is absolutely simpler.
Yep.
And it's absolutely easier.
Mm-hmm.
The fairer bit is where you run into some questions. This is. I'll try and be political about it. Talk about the economics and the philosophy of it. Mm. So the idea is, look, if everyone pays the same portion of income, then that's on one level really, really fair, right? Earn a buck, I earn $100, I earn $1,000, I earn $10,000, I pay the same percentage of that as income.
Well, that's what happens with companies. The company rate of tax is 30%.
Right.
You're a $1 billion company, you're a small one, 30%.
Correct. The difference here is on an equity level, the argument, and I won't come down necessarily on one side or the other, but the argument is that it's kind of what's left after the process and how fair it is that if you earn $40,000 a year and you're paying a 30-cent tax rate, for example, you're earning $200,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's fair in one version of the future. Say everyone pays the same rate of tax. Mm-hmm. I earn more, I pay more dollars, but the same percentage. That seems fair.
Mm-hmm.
The other version of fair is after I paid my tax. Now, if I earn $40,000 a year, how much have I got left for my living expenses, my rents, the tolls, food, warmth, bills, versus someone who pays $200,000? And on an equity basis, is it fair that the amount left over for people who are, let's assume they're both working hard, they're both working to their capacity, one person's in a job that society values more than the other, for example, a surgeon versus a road digger. Mm. If they both work 40 hours, 60 hours a week, they're getting very, very different after-tax amounts. And so to some people, fairness would be, it's fair for someone earning a heap more, as in literally five times more, to pay a slightly higher proportion of that income in tax because they've got so much left after tax that to some degree, they can afford to, and it would be reasonable on a societal basis to say those who can afford to should. Those who can't afford as much shouldn't have to pay as much.
So it's kind of the redistribution argument, just to sort of make society a little bit flatter, less stratified.
Yeah, exactly. So to some degree, if you're earning $200,000, you're paying your 30% tax, you probably, I won't do the numbers now, but you've probably got $120,000 odd left over.
Yep.
If you're earning $40,000 a year, you've probably got $35,000-$36,000 left over.
Mm-hmm.
If some would say that's fair because it's the same rate of tax, other people would say, well, you still end up with three times as much. How is that fair, in inverted commas?
Mm.
And that's kind of where the whole thing breaks down. Okay. So, look, I'm generally in favor of a progressive system. I think it's reasonable to pay a little bit more if you earn a little bit more in percentage terms as well as in dollars. So I think a progressive system is fairer and probably societally better, but that kind of gets straight into opinion now.
I think from a policy perspective,
you can have a different view.
Until I start earning more than $200,000 a year, and then I am dead against it. I'm dead against it once over.
Mate, that's a first-class problem, right?
Like, isn't it?
At some level, I do have to say, people who are saying, I earn $100,000 a year and I shouldn't have to pay more tax on someone earning $60,000 a year, there's a fair degree of self-deception. I think you wouldn't trade places, would you? That's the answer, right? If you earn that much money, you're really going to begrudge paying extra 5 percentage points in tax. I think that's there's some element of kind of, what society do you want to live in? For me, I'd rather live in a society where, everyone's got enough to get on. I think that would be a reasonable thing. I think from a tax system perspective, we can help that to be true. But that's horrible. That's complete opinion and not in the politics.
Okay, let's move away from the politics quickly. And before we move on from the budget, one thing I thought was it's gotten a bit of traction in the media and hopefully gets a bit more. But what was one thing that was very fascinating about it was that we've just going through this Banking Royal Commission, which we've talked about a lot.
Jesus.
We've seen how dodgy the whole bloody industry is. And what does the budget propose? Cutting how much money out of the corporate watchdog?
I don't know the exact total. They're cutting 30 jobs out of ASIC. ASIC is the business that the regulator should say whose job it is to keep tabs on the banks.
Mm.
And for a government who was dragged kicking and screaming to the Royal Commission in the first place, this is just absolutely staggering. That a government could think in everything they're spending and saving, they're literally going to cut jobs out of a regulator who was already too stretched to catch this stuff before the Royal Commission, and that somehow with fewer staff, ASIC is somehow better.
To be fair, we will get a Captain Cook statue. So,
that's a fair trade-off.
Six of one, half a dozen of the other, right?
Captain Cook is the best banking regulator.
Did we say we were going to be apolitical?
Zero to you.
Real money advice from real people, not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
We better move on, my friend. We are fast running out of time.
We've got some mail, mate.
Read us out the first one.
I will. So we got three good bits of mail. The first one came from Grant, turtle_GGEE on Twitter. And Grant was asking about, speaking of things political and other, sugar taxes.
Mm.
And so he said, hey, Scott, what are your thoughts on a sugar tax? Will you be writing about the pros and cons of such a tax? Now, I said, mate, great question. Look, sugar and health isn't really my thing. But, generally, I'm coming in favour. He said, thanks for the reply. I think
in favour of sugar?
In favour of the tax.
Oh, okay.
He said, thanks for the I drink Coke Zero, man. I'm all about artificial sweeteners. You know that. He said, thanks for the reply. I think the science is in. What I would love to hear from you guys is, do taxes like this work? And so, you know, again, we'll talk about the sugar tax a little bit, but it's more the question of taxes generally. And, you know, does this sort of thing, whether you think it should be in place or not, would it work if it was? And that's the key question.
Haven't they done it over in the UK fairly recently?
They have, and they've also tried different versions of this in the US.
Yep.
It's a fascinating thing because it really comes straight down to the laws of supply and demand. Mm-hmm. And we know that unless something is addictive or somehow has different attributes at play.
So nicotine and cigarettes are the classic example.
Exactly.
There, right?
And look, cigarettes are useful, right? Because the combination of education and tax has dramatically reduced the amount of smoking. Now, we can argue about which part of which was it. Was it education? Right. Was it tax? Was it both? Was it neither?
Yep.
You can have those arguments. I think, frankly, mate, people tend to argue those on ideological lines rather than looking for evidence.
As is so often the case.
But for the sugar tax, I think the nicotine tax or the tobacco tax is a really, really great example. Mm. And I think that's the combination again. This is the question really comes down to what role do you think government should have in, and again, we won't necessarily get the politics of it, but ideologically, the reality is we know for a fact in every walk of life, including, for example, the carbon tax, again, same thing. Mm. When you add a tax, adding taxes put prices up. When prices go up, people use less of it. So whether that's energy, whether that's nicotine, whether that's beer, whether that's whatever else, we know that price has an inversely proportional relationship to demand. Mm-hmm. As price goes up, demand falls. As price goes down, demand rises. Mm. Again, carbon tax went on, energy use fell. Mm-hmm. Carbon tax comes off, energy use rises again. Tobacco, we've seen over decades that increasing prices, as well as education, has an impact. If you're of the belief, and to Grant's question, he wants to know, does it work? Absolutely, the evidence is well and truly in that increasing the price of anything, whether by a tax or something else, you do decrease the demand. Mm. Would there be less sugar consumed if there was a sugar tax? Absolutely. The answer is yes. You can decide whether you think that's a good idea or not, but conceptually straightforward, economics 101, price goes up, demand goes down, you want less sugar consumed, increasing the price is one way of achieving that.
And beyond just perhaps, see, the argument often comes down to, it's a nanny state, you know, it's my choice as to whether I want to have a bunch of sugar or not. And I have sympathy with that, but where I feel as though it's reasonable for a government to do this is because there are direct costs to society and the government. So the person who has, you know, 12 Krispy Kremes for breakfast is probably going to be consuming a far greater proportion of the health budget, for example. And so it is reasonable to think that if you're more likely to be drawing on resources there, that you need to tip more in. So it has this wonderful benefit. Yes, it makes you healthier and as a better incentivizes you to do the right thing, but it also has big longer term payoff in reducing our healthcare spending.
You know what's funny? I actually think a sugar tax is a good idea, but I actually disagree with that as a reason. The answer is because you're going to die of something at some point anyway. Okay. And there's every decent chance that if you don't die of a heart attack because of Krispy Kremes, you're going to die of something else. And the last year of healthcare costs reasonably the same for most of us on average, regardless of what you die of.
But it's not just about dying, though. It's the 20 years of type 2 diabetes and the cost that comes with that. It's these, you know, huge spectrum of health related issues that aren't necessarily, you know, mortality related, but have significant costs on the health system.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, and I haven't sourced for the conversation, I didn't know we're going to go this direction. I'm pretty sure the tobacco...
Do we ever know which direction we're going to go?
We'll cut that bit out.
Okay.
So I didn't check this beforehand, but so the tobacco tax, I'm pretty sure, raises far, far more than it covers in related health costs because there's so much tax on it right now. And I think, so, you know, there is arguments about if you're going to use the health budget at some point, whether you get cancer, whether you get diabetes, whether you get whatever, there's an indirect correlation. You're going to die of something eventually. So being... the incremental cost of that is far less than people would otherwise assume. That is, if you die of a heart attack versus cancer because you didn't or didn't have the Krispy Kremes, the last year of your life is probably going to cost roughly the same on average. I think what I would say for what it's worth is that it's if you're going to raise a tax, you might as well raise a tax by taxing the thing you want less of. That's kind of taxation 101, is you tax the things you want less of. And that's what people frankly say about income is, you know, do we really want to tax income when we actually want people to go and work and earn money? At some level, yeah, if we're taxing the less ideal things in society and as a result raising the revenue we need anyway, but doing it in such a way that we are encouraging people to take different choices, you kind of manage to achieve both aims there. You have better public health outcomes and you still raise the money you need. Far better that than taxing something that otherwise isn't necessarily negative, like income or something else. a smart government might say, well, let's aim for taxation on the stuff that is negative for health, negative for societal outcomes.
Okay, quick fire round. Let's fire through a couple more.
Excellent. One from Natalie Perez. Mate, you can have this one. Hey, guys, love the podcast. We're a young couple. This is awesome. And we have started investing in the stock market, which I love. So they're 25, which is awesome. We are set on buying the index. We've also changed our super to low-fee index-based super. Are we not better off just maximizing our super to 15% and investing in the index? That way, enjoy some tax benefits rather than doing it outside the super system. I know tax should be the main reason, but we'd be investing in an index fund either way. Am I missing something? Aside from the ability to withdraw the money until retirement, obviously. Thanks so much. Look forward to your show each week. I could have left that last bit out, but you know I like to put the compliments in, so it makes me feel better.
For sure.
So Natalie's saying she's doing an inside super. I'm saving some tax. Isn't that the best thing to do?
Yeah, it is, on the proviso that you're happy to leave that untouched until you retire.
Yep.
And it's great that she's thinking so long term, because, you know, a lot of people in their 20s, you know, retirement, man, I'm in my 40s and retirement seems like an eon away. I struggle to.
That's very close for you.
It's scarily close, but you know, I do struggle to conceive of that. And I think that, so if they were looking to at some point buy a, maybe, I don't know their situation, but maybe let's say hypothetical, the stereotypical couple looking to save up to buy a house, that money is obviously not going to be accessible for that. So that is the question. If, on the other hand, you genuinely are putting this aside long-term for your retirement, then those, you know, again, she's right. You don't invest on tax reasons alone.
Correct.
But the tax savings are so substantial and they're going to compound, you know, just such a massive degree that the difference, it's like those super industry ads where they sort of
compare the pair.
We're
doing the hand thing. Ready to do the hand thing?
And all they do.
There you go. We're doing the hand. Liam, can you just tell us we're doing the hand thing?
And the only difference is they talk about the fees and we see how massive, like in dollar terms,
right,
that is.
Right, right.
And so, yes, I would say if you can wait that long, then absolutely keep it within super, with the caveat, and again, maybe this is the cynic in me coming out, that I would almost guarantee that the government will change the rules
exactly
at some point, or they'll look to dip into that in some way, shape or form, or they'll push back the age at which you can claim it, or all of these kinds of things. So there's also an argument too. I tend to balance it off. I keep some out, I put some in.
Yeah.
It's a personal choice.
It's a little word called optionality, and the amount of optionality you want, you're going to pay something for that optionality. Mm. And to the extent you keep your money outside super, you're foregoing the tax deduction. Mm. So you have the option of maybe, you know, if you want to, let's say you're incredibly great at saving and investing, and you got enough money at 53 to stop working. Mm. If all that money's inside super, and the government says you can't touch it till 60, you're kind of stuffed, right? Because you can't get it out. So you got to wait 7 years. Like, I'd rather be not working, but I have to because I can't access my cash.
Yeah. Even if you've got your gazillion dollars.
Literally. Yeah. So look, I'm not like you. I think they absolutely look at 25. Yes, maximize your super because do it now. It'll compound forever. But at some point, just think about the optionality of being able to, for example, retire at 45 or 40. If you're great at saving and investing, you want to go and live a low-cost lifestyle somewhere in country New South Wales or somewhere else, go and do that by all means. Just be mindful that you can't touch that cash. And while it doesn't feel like at 25 a big deal, if you get to 55 and think, gee, I wish I had left some money outside so I can wait for the majority to come back to me at 60 or whatever age the government says. But in the meantime, I've got some money to do what I want.
Okay. Next question from Maximus Power.
Now you have to read the bottom one first, Andrew, because Max, Matt actually, it was Matt Power.
Matt M Power.
So Matt did get in touch and he said, love the podcast, gents. On. I think it means full on. In question time, how do I invest directly in international equities? Mm. And comments on international tax implications. Then he says, Andrew often talks about holding Amazon. And then a minute later, he sent the same thing back with Scott, often talks about holding Amazon. I gave Matt a little bit of grief for that. So Matt, thanks for letting me have a bit of fun with you. I didn't want to let the first thing go. I'm the one who holds Amazon and have done reasonably well, Andrew. I don't think you own Amazon.
That's the only reason why you wanted to clarify. Let's be honest here.
There's a reason I put both of those in the run sheet, mate.
So it's an excellent question.
How do you invest in international, Andrew?
It's very easy. It's the same way that you would go about investing in domestic shares. You've got to set up a trading account with a stockbroker.
Right.
He mentions CommSec. Yep, as good as any. Actually, no.
Which one do you use?
I'm going to... I don't invest directly overseas.
What?
I know.
Tesla,
that's a very, very good idea.
Right?
Yes. How do I explain this quickly? So, okay, let me answer the question first. So you just go to... I would actually... Yep. I use CommSec, actually, and that's just for historic reads because I'm lazy, and that was the first account I opened.
Most
up,
of us do.
I've never bothered to switch, and that's embarrassing. And
admit. Well, they're also pretty good, right? Like, it's relatively inexpensive brokerage, relatively good customer service, relatively good website.
That's all true. That's all true. Yep. But when it comes to international, they're hopeless. And I say this without fear or favour. There's no kickbacks or anything here. But I would, when you look at the brokerage costs for international trading, there are providers there that are much, much, much cheaper than CommSec.
Correct.
Having said that, if you're the kind of long-term buy hold type investor, you're not going to be trading your pants off, then it's probably, there's not much of a difference here. So it's probably an argument to say whoever you're using domestically, just keep it all together and go with them.
I think that's fair. I would say that about saving $5 between CommSec and a local other discount broker.
Yeah.
You can trade CommSec for $20 on the ASX, or if others were 15. Mm. I'd never bother changing away from CommSec because it's much of a muchness.
Yeah.
To some degree, though, I don't know what the current CommSec rates are, but they have historically been like multiples of the price of investing internationally. Mm. So I use Options Express.
They're
called Charles Schwab now. Mm. I use Charles Schwab. Other people use Interactive Brokers.
I've heard good things about Interactive Brokers.
I think I would not worry about commissions for their own sake, except where those numbers are just too big a gap.
Yep.
So, frankly, if you're spending $20 on a $1,000 trade, that's 2%. If you're spending $50, that's 5%. So it's kind of, even though it doesn't feel like all that much more, it's kind of half a year's gain you're kind of giving up just for the sake of having an expensive broker. So if the prices are much for muchness, I agree with you, Andrew, I'd go local. Mm-hmm. I'm happy with Charles Schwab. I actually wouldn't recommend Interactive Brokers for what it's worth, only because that's a really, really complex trading screen. It's a bugger to use. We use it for work for some of our real money portfolios because the company has an account with Interactive Brokers. It's fine. They're great. Mm. But it's not particularly user-friendly. So I would go with CommSec or maybe Charles Schwab if I was forced to make a choice.
Mm-hmm. The second part of the question is the tax implications. There are tax implications.
There are.
There are withholding taxes and other kind of stuff we just don't have time to get into. It's not a major swing factor as to why you would or wouldn't, but there certainly are. And there's also currency impacts as well. Yep. So if the Aussie dollar rises substantially, that's going to take the edge off some of your gains.
I'm going to take 30 seconds and go into those tax implications, Andrew, because I think
you're going to talk about a WBEN form.
I'm not going to talk about that, but you do have to fill it out. All I wanted to say is there is no downside to investing internationally from a tax perspective, other than you miss out on franking credits that we get here in Australia. Right. So you don't pay any extra taxes by investing in the US. Any withholding taxes that are taken by the US government, you can offset against your Australian tax payable.
It's just an administrative.
As a form to fill out. Don't be discouraged by taxes, is my net. Capital gains tax. You pay the same tax on income. You have to fill out one form to make it happen. Don't be discouraged by tax. Go and do it anyway. You will be almost certainly happy you did if you're buying quality companies that give you good long-term compound returns.
And just to explain myself very quickly, I do have
in general
a
or
bunch,
about this.
Just about this, oh, I do okay, have good. A bunch Remember of exposure to offshore markets, in particular the US. But I do that through low-cost ETFs. I'm a very active investor when it comes to local shares. Mm-hmm. When it comes to getting exposure to the Berkshires, the Apples, the Amazons, I've got a bunch of ETFs that do that. It's just a bandwidth question for me.
We might talk about that next week.
Yeah, it's a good question.
All right.
I think we've run out of time for the high horse, mate. I'm sad to say. I'm admitting that. I'm admitting that because we're 32 minutes in.
I'm not going to disagree with you, dude.
Okay.
I'm going to do it next week. That's
all right,
fine.
We'll do it next week.
If you forget, I'll do mine and we'll be even happier.
Now, you did the intro. Does that mean I have to do the... Do I have to wrap it up?
To the outro, as they call it in trade. That's because we're radio professionals, dude.
True professionals.
We're 101st podcast.
Hey.
We're almost Hall of Fame entrance.
Almost.
Give another couple of thousand episodes and we might possibly score an invite to
the longest journey starts with a single step.
Or 100 bad podcasts.
That almost wraps it up. But before we go, don't forget you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes and your favorite Android podcast app.
And you should.
And if you like what we're doing, please give us a fat 5-star rating on iTunes and tell your friends. I'm sure they could do with some foolish straight talk too. And you can get a little bit more at fool.com.au/Triple M. Until next week, I'm Andrew Page.
And I'm Scott Phillips.
Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.